This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, 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 everyone. This is Rob Wolf, and welcome to episode number 76 of Unformettable, where we take a look at some of the less heralded players in our beloved franchise's quirky history. As to us, every player who dons the orange and blue is in some way unformettable. Well, I went heavy on the baseball books this winter, first reading Lords of the Realm, which was a truly engrossing history of baseball's labor disputes by John Hilliar, written in the 90s, so kind of just up to and including the 94 World Series cancellation and the aftermath of that. But it was really a splendid and exhaustive book on baseball's labor history that I strongly recommend. It also made me sad that I had already done a Claudel Washington Unformettable, as I was surprised how prominently his contract and free agent signing was looked at as one of the major problems. A middling player, I guess, getting superstar-type money. And Ted Turner at the time kind of rivaled George Steinbrenner as a hated owner. At any rate, I just remembered being 6 years old and being sad that the one talented young player the Mets had actually just acquired for half a season was already gone. But after some real fiction reading, I had to turn to another baseball book to kick off the season, as is tradition, or personal tradition at any rate. So I read a book my friend got me for Christmas this year called When Shea Was Home by Britt Topol. Not an exhaustive Shea or Mets history, as the title kind of portends. Its main focus is the 1975 season, when, due to the two-year renovation of Yankee Stadium, Shea served as the home for each of the Mets, Yankees, Jets, and Giants for the entire year. And yes, it was a two-year renovation, but in 74, the Giants used the Yale Bowl in Connecticut as their home stadium while they were awaiting the Meadowlands opening. So while 74 is covered in the book, it really focuses exclusively on 75. Well, largely, not exclusively. I'll spare you the rest of the book review, or, you know, maybe I'll throw some more in at the end. But in addition to being a testament to the skill of longtime Mets groundskeeper, head groundskeeper Pete Flynn, who was probably one of the hardest working people in New York that year, the book also reminded me of a memorable game in Mets history for a very unformettable type player. In very Mets fashion, in 1975, in August, a little-known, overlooked, one-season-only hurler looked to be on the verge of an unexpected and historic first no-hitter in franchise history, only to promptly lose the no-hitter, the game, and perhaps indirectly or almost directly end Yogi Berra's tenure as Mets manager. So let's say come on down to this week's subject, the unformettable Randy Tate. So Randall Lee Tate was born on October 3rd, 1952, in Florence, Alabama. A true Alabama lad, he was born there, eventually, very recently in fact, passed away there, and grew up there, attended Lexington High School in Florence, where he was a top athlete in multiple sports, and he was drafted by the New York Mets in the fifth round of the 1972 January draft, out of Calhoun Community College in Decatur, Alabama. The 19-year-old had a rough entry into professional ball. He went to the Appalachian League in rookie ball, where he went 0-9 with a 6 ERA. He over his 60 innings, he walked 54 and struck out 60, also throwing 20 wild pitches over those 60 innings. He was a lanky left-hander who could throw pretty hard, but as those stats might indicate, was pretty wild. His fastball control was average at best, but getting his curveball over consistently was a huge challenge for Tate. And frankly, those walk-to-strikeout numbers would never truly improve, or not dramatically, which probably explains his brief career. In 1973 in A-ball, he walked 88 and struck out 82. He would go 4-10 that year, but his first victory would be memorable. He would, in fact, throw that no-hitter that barely eluded him in the majors. It was a 7-inning no-hitter, though. His first professional win, June 8th, 2-0 no-hitter, in which he walked 5 and struck out 7 over 7 innings, and what I presume was a doubleheader, assuming those were the minor league rules back then as well. In 1974, when in both Topol's book and real life, the Yankees were invading our beloved Shea Stadium for the first of two seasons, Tate would split his season between Single-A and Triple-A. He was working hard with pitching coach Billy Connors to try and gain better control of his curveball, with mixed results. His ERA and one-loss record improved greatly, but he was still prone to bouts of wildness, as his 158 walks to 172 strikeouts over 176 innings in his two stops in 74 would attest. Tate did have one big fan in the Mets organization, though, and that was an important one in manager Yogi Berra. Tate pitched in an exhibition game between the Tides and the Mets and allowed only 2 hits over 7 innings and impressed Berra greatly with his live arm. Tate then joined the Mets in an exhibition tour that the team made of Japan after the 1974 season, and again impressed manager Berra, who stated during the tour that the 22-year-old was going to be a hell of a pitcher. And Berra pretty much had it in mind, according to what I could read, that Tate should be targeted for the 1975 rotation, even though he had only 17 innings of experience above A-ball at that point. And a live arm Tate may have had, but Dwight Gooden he was not. Now, the Mets had followed up their you-gotta-believe pennant run in 1973 with an incredibly disappointing 71-91 fifth-place finish in 74. After that season, the team traded away Tug McGraw, who did have a tough 74 season, and tried to supplement their offense to bolster a pitching staff still led by Seaver, Kuzman, and Matlack. They brought in Dave Kingman, which was a pretty successful, although of course all or nothing, addition to the offense, and less successfully, an aging, faded, formerly great hitter in Joe Torre. But as was already starting to be embedded in the franchise's DNA, the team would go as far as its pitching would take it. And that top trio was strong, but there wasn't much depth. And as mentioned, Berra really did favor Tate. So the 22-year-old pretty much was installed as fourth starter ahead of swingmen George Stone and Hank Webb for a team that, while coming off a tough season, was, you know, 1 year removed from the NL pennant and definitely had hopes of contending again. So to an extent, Berra probably was going into the season in a bit of a hot seat and with some expectations attached to the team. Not to say his fate was inextricably tied with Tate's, but he certainly put a lot of faith in the young man. And it looked like a pretty good move early, making his major league debut on April 14th of 1975 in the team's fifth game of the season. Tate held a strong Phillies offense scoreless through the first 7 2/3 innings of his outing. He took a 3-0 lead into the eighth inning and retired the first two batters, but in a bit of an eerie precursor to his lost no-hitter, It all went away very quickly. In quick succession, Tate surrendered a walk, a double, and then a home run to Greg Luzinski that tied up a game. The Mets would go on to lose on a Mike Schmidt home run in the bottom of the ninth, dropping the team to 1-4 on the young season. Tate did complete 8 innings, 3 runs, 3 walks, and 7 strikeouts in a no decision that, you know, would have to stand as a pretty strong debut for a young 22-year-old lefty. And obviously that was the 70s and not today, and, you know, you don't get to the 8th inning with a perfect game these days, much less a shutout. But even in the standards of those days, perhaps Yogi pushed the young starter too far, making his major league debut. And again, it would not be the last time Yogi would seem to leave Tate in a bit too long. But the next time we will talk about would indeed be the last time, at least for Yogi. Making his second start, a few days later, Tate would go 6 scoreless against the Chicago Cubs, April 20th, earning the first of his 5 career major league wins. He did walk 5 and strike out only 2 in the game, however. As the 75 season progressed, like you would expect from most young pitchers, Tate was very up and down. After those first 2 very impressive starts, he would lose 3 in a row, including a inning and a third 5-run debacle to the Houston Astros. But still in all, through June 28th, as perhaps the high watermark of his career numbers, his record was only 3-6, but Tate was pitching to a 3.22 ERA, culminating on that June 28th with a complete game, one of 2 he recorded in his career, where he was victorious over the Phillies 5-2. For the franchise, the victory moved the Mets to 36-32, only 4.5 games behind the first place Pittsburgh Pirates, and third place and only 1.5 games behind the Phillies for second. The Mets would kind of just tread water through July, and Tate would pitch a lot worse, though. He would, by the end of that month, he would have fallen to a record of 4-9, so going 1-3 in the month, but his ERA leapt from 3.22 to 4.64 after another, one-and-two-third inning outing against the Cardinals on July 30th, in which he got bombed again. The Mets, of course, lost that game, and that dropped them to 53-48, so still a little above 500. But the Pirates were beginning to surge, and the team found themselves 9 games behind Pittsburgh, going into a pretty crucial 5-game series against the Pirates. And while the Mets got off to a great start in that series, winning the first 3 games, bringing themselves to 6 out of first place, and reaching perhaps a peak above 500 on the season of 56-48. They would close out the series by getting swept in a doubleheader to drop back to 56-50, 8 games behind the Pirates. So perhaps the letdown of that didn't help, but still hoping to hang on the edges of contention there. The Mets came back to Shea to face the Montreal Expos after that big 5-game series, returning home to take on the Montreal Expos on Monday, August 4th, 1975, when Randy Tate would flirt with a little Mets history. Tate was on from the start in that game. He struck out 10 batters over the first 5 innings, including burgeoning Expo star Gary Carter twice. The occasionally wild young pitcher had allowed only 1 walk, but no hits through those 5 innings. Unfortunately for him, for the first 4 innings at least, Tate was almost completely matched by future Mets pitching coach Dan Warthen, who was the Expos starter that day, and who was able to match him pretty nicely through 4 innings, where the Mets had only 1 hit through. But they broke through for 3 runs in the fifth in the bottom of the fifth against Wharton, largely on the strength of a Gene Kline's triple, with a little help from an error. Only 2 of the runs were earned, but that staked the team and Tate to a 3-0 lead. Tate kept the Expos hitless through the next 2 innings, but his command began to fade, as he did walk three more batters over the sixth and seventh innings. Still, with the score still 3-0 in the top of the eighth, Tate came out to the Shea Mound to try and complete the no-hitter and started the inning with his 13th strikeout of the night of Jose Morales. But the next batter, Jim Little, came in to pinch hit for the pitcher and stroked a single to left to leave Tate with 7 1/3 hitless innings and erase any hopes of history for young Tate or for a franchise-first no-hitter. The next batter was Pepe Mangual, who Tate promptly walked, bringing the tying run up to the plate in the form of Carter, and that brought Berra out to the mound. Tate was young, according to reports, seemed to be tiring, and the Mets were, of course, still in the pennant race, but Tate stayed in to face Carter, who ripped a single to left to cut the score to 3-1. If people thought Tate was getting the hook before Carter, they likely thought he would now, with the go-ahead run coming to the plate. But the only vote that mattered didn't go along with that plan. Perhaps playing the lefty-lefty percentages, Berra left Tate in to face Mike Jorgensen, who launched a 3-run homer to right center. So now, in the span of 4 batters, the no-hitter and then the lead were gone for the Mets. After the game, asked about not pulling him, Berra said, "I was going to give him one more batter. What are the odds of a guy hitting a home run like that? Don't blame the kid for the home run. Blame me if you're going to blame someone." And it would seem that someone in the Mets front office took Berra at his word. The following day, the Mets were swept by the Expos in a doubleheader by identical 7-0 scores. And after that day in those two games, Berra was fired as Mets manager. Perhaps not a direct result of the Tate game, but certainly didn't help. Berra's replacement, Roy McMillan, apparently didn't have the same belief in Tate that Berra did. He did start a couple of more games. The last one he started was a complete game victory over the Padres on August 26th, which actually marked Tate's fifth and final career win. But after that game, he was moved to the bullpen and rarely used down the stretch in September, getting one final start in the penultimate game of the season, which would ultimately be his last major league appearance on September 27th, 1975, in which he was unfortunately matched up with Steve Carlton. Tate would only go an inning and a third, allowing 3 runs on 1 hit, walking 6, and striking out 3 in a game in which Carlton would one-hit the Mets, Felix Mian recording the only hit and RBI double in the top of the 6th inning in the Mets' 8-1 loss to the Phillies. And it's a weird and kind of quirky thing to me. I don't know how many people have played, a full season, but that being their only professional major league season, no other cups of coffee, no other, lines on the back of the baseball card for Randy Tate, just one full and complete 1975 season with the Mets. Tate played winter ball in Puerto Rico in 75, and later said that he pulled a muscle there, working as a reliever, which he thought affected him in 1976 training camp. So he had a poor camp, got assigned to AAA Tidewater, and pitched poorly there, recording an ERA over 6. Mets actually moved him all the way back down to Class A in 77, hoping he could regain some lost confidence and control, but his control actually started getting worse, so he really never got back above A ball in the Mets organization. The team released him, and he latched on with the Pirates in 1978 and got as high as AAA, but tore his rotator cuff, which eventually brought his career to an end at the age of 25. For his career, for that 1 year major league career, Tate was 5-13 for the 1975 Mets with a 4.45 ERA. He appeared in 26 games, starting 23 of them, threw 137 2/3 innings, struck out 99, walked 86. He actually had a much better FIP than ERA. He actually had a FIP of 3.89 despite a whip over 1.5, which I thought was a little surprising. I guess he did keep the ball in the yard and only surrendered 8 home runs, including that fateful one to Jorgensen. And overall, by Baseball Reference WAR, Tate's career was a negative 0.7 WAR. Only negative 0.1 for pitching, though. If you dig a little deeper, he recorded an impressive negative 0.6 for his batting. For, I know it's 2022, and I guess we just don't talk about pitchers hitting anymore ever again, but Randy Tate was historic in his hitting futility. And I guess, now that I think about it, would be a good argument for the DH, so I digress. But Tate was a perfect, if you will, 0-for-41 as a batter in his major league career. And in fact, if you look up most at-bats in a season without a hit by a pitcher, he is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6th. All-time in futility. Bob Buell of the Cubs in 1962 was 0-for-69. Nice. Bill White, 0-for-61. Ron Herbel, 0-for-47. Carl Drews of the Cardinals in 1949, 0-for-46. Ernie Kube and Randy Tate, 0-for-41. Next on that list of futility. He did, in fact, score 2 runs on the year, including one in the no-hitter game. He came around on the triple by Clines after a failed sacrifice bunt attempt. But I thought that was an interesting little footnote as well. Tate returned to Alabama after his career ended. Seemed to live most, if not all, of his non-baseball life there. Worked some odd jobs, including welding, and apparently became very interested in gardening as a hobby and a somewhat prolific gardener from what I had read and could find, though information was limited. Sadly, Tate died just this March of 2021 from complications related to COVID-19 during the pandemic at the age of 68. It was an interesting book when Shea was home, certainly not my favorite Met book, in part because I didn't even fully consider it a Met book. I mean, it really led with the Yankees, which I guess is what was quirky about that season, and tried hard to kind of cover everything, including a little bit of New York and, you know, American history in 75, Watergate, New York's financial issues. That at times made it feel a little all over the place for me, but it really was a fascinating read, and, you know, I was less than a year old at the time, so it was just interesting to think that Shea Stadium hosted, I think it was 178 professional games. I mean, it would be 162 baseball games and 16 football games, basically from, like, April to December. It's just daunting to think of. And now that I'm thinking about it, I remember that one game in 98 where the Yankees played at Shea. Maybe I'm glad I did not see the Yankees playing at Shea Stadium for a full season. I might not have enjoyed that. For the Mets, 75 was the tail end of period of relevance. They're 86 and 76 in 1976, but finished well behind a dominant Phillies team before, of course, the dark days of 77 to 83 would descend over Shea. But for Randy Tate, 75 was a memorable year. It was the only year. And even though he didn't quite complete that first no-hitter in Mets history, he was nonetheless unformidable. Thanks for taking the time to listen to Unformidable. Please go to AmazingAvenue.com for more Mets-related content and follow us on the social medias. You can find this and all of our amazing pods wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe, leave a review, it helps us out. Original music by Bunga. I'm on Twitter at WolfRR, WOLFFRR, and the show is at Unformidable. Thank you, and as always, let's go Mets.